Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Welcome to episode 67 of Comic Book Nation, the official podcast of comicbook.com. I am your host, Kofi Outlaw, and with me today, my co-host, Matthew Aguilar.
What's up, everybody?
And back on the couch with us, Mr. Turnip Charlie Ridgely.
What's up?
Nothing, man. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I didn't expect you to ask me a
question. Why was that so awkward?
I didn't expect him to ask me a question back. I thought he was just going to, like,
wave. It was very awkward.
It was a pleasant greeting. So, today, Charlie is with us because we're going to be doing quite a bit. We are going to review the new season of American Horror Story, 1984. All of us are going to dive deep into some big game-changing things that just happened to the X-Men and Marvel's House of X. We will also be getting into a few new stories, but I thought we'd start off with grenade time. See, you never know when it's coming, these grenades these days. So, in our grenade segment, we like to just kind of toss a topic into the room that people have been talking about, or more like arguing about, and just see if we can't get some quick opinions here. You never know. I mean, we've had a good grenade. We've had a grenade that blew up into thing. Charlie started this whole thing with his crazy views on in Marvel's Eternals.
You really
today,
were the origin.
I cannot
of
wait for that movie to be.
And today,
awesome.
I mean, it's fun today because we're going for a kind of a Marvel versus DC kind of conversation, which is the new projections for DC's Joker are out, and it's looking like Joker is going to be kind of a good box office success. And the opening in October is coming now up against a previous record holder for projections, which is Sony's Venom movie. The question in our grenade today is, do you think Joker can beat Venom? And now, let me say what I'm asking. This is opening weekend box office we're talking. We're talking about shooting in the 80 millions range to be able to kind of dethrone Venom. Got to go high 80 millions, I think. And the question is kind of pertinent here is, Joker is a very kind of stripped down, low budget, almost like DC indie movie type deal. And it's rated R. So there are factors to this. Mm-hmm. And it's rated R. And as we've discussed on here previously, there are certain factors to it that could really put off a lot of people from coming to the theater to see this, especially in the current social climate. Whereas Venom is just like big, dumb superhero movie. Escape is fun. It was PG-13. It was a much bigger movie and, you know, kind of campaign behind it. Not to say Joker hasn't had publicity. Obviously it has. Yeah. But it's not on the level of as a studio blockbuster like Venom. Mm-hmm. So, if it were to kind of dethrone Venom, it would just be not just an achievement for DC to feather in its cap, but like it would be the proof of concept that Todd Phillips kind of pitched to this studio about how to approach this and what they could achieve with, you know, achieving so much with so little. Do you think that with all the factors, the rating, the subject matter, this current social climate, do you think it's possible?
Charlie. You put so many things to answer and unpack. Like, do I think it's possible to beat Venom? 100%. Like, I think it's kind of a foregone conclusion at this point. Venom was, I think, $80.2 million opening weekend in October. And Joker's right now looking at 82.
Are we talking
do you think these... I mean, my real question, I guess, to spin this around is, do you think these projections are on point? Do you think...
But is the argument opening weekend or
opening
is it
week?
Yeah, yeah. Because overall, Venom's going to beat Joker because of the international. Yeah. But the international audiences aren't going to come out for this R-rated, you know, very serious, you know, dark look at this. I mean, it'll do okay, but you're not going to have.
We're talking about the record, for
right?
October
The okay. opening weekend record. I think it'll absolutely smash Venom. You know, Venom, while it had the appeal of a blockbuster, it also had a lot of really negative reviews, and it put a lot of people off. And so it was this really mixed reaction going in, and it only got to succeed based on the strength of the character of Venom. And when you look at Joker, it has the critical accolades. It has the, you know, the backing of the, you know, Shazam and Aquaman were the last two DC movies. It kind of has, you know, that momentum going in. It has a very low budget. It has all these things, but more than anything, it has the name Joker. And this movie could have been a total flop, and it was going to make money for DC because it only cost like $50 million to make, you know, to make a movie about Joker, one of the most iconic characters of all time, with that little money. No matter what happened, it wasn't going to fail. And the fact that it's getting the praise and getting the Oscar conversation and just getting the social conversation, like, I don't know if I've seen a movie, I haven't looked at the stats, but I don't know if I've seen a movie this year tweeted about or talked about on social media more than Joker outside of Avengers Endgame. And so when you look at the conversation happening, everyone is so interested to see what this is, even if some people are a little worried about the content or they're not sure how they feel about this kind of movie, or they don't necessarily always like to go to those gritty R-rated things, they're going to go see it because it's Joker and because there's so much conversation around it.
Yeah, I'm just saying, let's just put this into context. Like, if it does unseat Venom and earns the record for biggest October opening, mm-hmm. that's monumental in the fact that it's an R-rated movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking about October, months that have had like Paranormal Activity, Saw movies, all these things. And so that would be a huge accomplishment.
Yeah.
I just want to clear that up in context.
Yeah.
Like, this is why I'm
it's definitely a monumental moment for, I want to say, for comic book movies, even though it's not really a comic book. It's not really a comic book movie. It is a character study. It is Taxi Driver with Joker slapped on the title and some clown makeup, which is the biggest selling point. But that, like you said, that kind of proves Todd's concept of, if you take little money with a popular character and do something a little bit different, it will sell. You know, people are going to this because it's called Joker, because Joker's never had a movie like that before.
Matt?
Right now it's what? It's 82 to 80? Is that the current?
So Venom made $80.2 million, yeah. And the projection from NRG, which is like the industry leader in box office tracking, NRG currently has Joker hitting $82 million over the course of the weekend.
Yeah. I mean, I could, I'm not as like sold on like it's a sure thing, I guess, because I look at it's, and it's really all about the rating for me. It's not about the critical acclaim and stuff, because I think absolutely Joker comes in with a much higher level of hype and appreciation, and like, oh my God, people know that this is going to be a good movie in addition to like having Joker as part of it. So I'm not doubting that at all. But I think the R rating does make a big difference when you're talking money and people showing up with a group rather than just
people. How much money did It Chapter 2 just make? Or Deadpool 2? Like,
I mean, yeah. But if you look at
sequels too.
Yeah, look at the first It. You know, I mean, this is the same thing. Like, even though It was a book before, and Joker is an established character.
Yeah. So I'm not saying he's not going to do well. I just think that I'm not as like, oh, it's a no-brainer that it will pass it. If it passes at 82, cool. I mean, that's a win. Cool. I don't necessarily care either, but I mean, I think it'll be, if it does, it'll be a small amount. It'll be a small
amount.
Yeah.
Okay. Charlie's saying a blowout. You're saying a small amount. I'm not saying anything at all.
What?
No, I'm not saying. I think it could. I think it's going to be. I think it's closer because, I mean, we're just seeing in the 80, and it seems like a simple, but there's a reason. I mean, Venom holds the record for that. So
but
it's not
do you remember last year when Venom came out? Do you remember the way that, you know, the articles we were writing about the conversation on social media and how much conversation it generated, because people were saying it was horrible, but then there was diehard fans saying no way, and people were debating about the content and whether or not it needed Spider-Man. And it feels very similar with Joker. Obviously, it's about different content and different circumstances and a different, do we need this conversation? But the energy on social media from fans feels very similar.
I'm not doubting Joker. I'm actually not doubting Joker as a long play movie. That word of mouth carries and awards kind of conversations heat up and that brings focus onto it. I'm just thinking about, I mean, we're talking about out of the gate momentum, like right.
Well, it also
is it going to be essential first week watching?
It's got no competition for that.
80's not
week,
small,
really.
Right? Like 80's not a small amount. I mean, so it just like we all kind of, I felt like we all had this discussion when Endgame was like, oh, it's going to sail past Avatar. And then it was like, come back to Earth a little bit because it took it a long time to get there and Marvel had to re-push it numerous times. Like, I know we look at these giant numbers sometimes and think, oh, that's nothing.
I mean, to be fair, Avatar was re-pushed like four times.
Yeah, I know. But I'm saying so many people, even some on this stage in this show were like, no brainer, it's done. And it wasn't. It was never an easy sell because 80 million, I feel like in this day and age, is a small number as we look at all these billion-dollar sales and all this other stuff. But it's still significant. It's still a lot.
For October it is.
For an October and for an R-rated film. No, it's a lot.
I totally agree.
All right, so we're not going to let this blow us up too much. We're going to keep on moving. We're going to be it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. It really will. I'm so interested to see how Joker lands. And so we're going to be keeping a watch on that. Moving right along, we're talking about a little fun thing that came out a couple days ago. We didn't talk about it on the last show. We didn't have time, but we're going to talk about it here. There's a new Jurassic World short film out by the original film's director, Colin Trevorrow, and it's called Jurassic World
Battle of Big Rock.
And it picks up right after the end of Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, which, spoilers for Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, spoilers, it ends with a girl getting cloned.
End with a girl getting cloned.
I know, that was just a big twist in it. I just wanted to troll Jurassic World. I'm just kidding. The real relevant thing for this short film is that at the end, a bunch of dinosaurs get released into the American wild and are out and kind of roaming about. And so basically this short film picks up with the concept of what happens when a family who's kind of out camping runs into an encounter with some of these dinosaurs that have been set loose. And we just wanted to bring it up because I wasn't expecting much. I mean, it was a short film, and I was like, oh, whatever, some kind of short. I know it was Colin Trevorrow, but that didn't exactly, like, make me instantly thrilled. But then I sat down and watched it, and it was really good. This was, like, the kind of Jurassic World movie I want to see next. Like, I would even take – I was thinking to myself, and I know this sounds crazy, but I would even take, like, a Pulp Fiction type multiple vignettes, like, of stories of people out and things are happening with these dinosaurs that kind of converges in some way at the end. Because it was great. It was kind of fun. Like, I mean, you could do it without, you know, actual Quentin Tarantino, like, chapters. Just like, cut scenes and
or
lengthy
do it
things.
Like Quentin Tarantino.
What's that?
So, or just do it like Quentin Tarantino.
Either way. Have a dinosaur just with its feet up. But, you know, like, but this was really good. It captured a lot of human drama. It has, like, the guy from Castle Rock in it.
Andrew Holland.
Yeah. And so, like.
And the woman from The Island on Netflix. I want you to watch that show so bad.
Why are you so excited?
Don't drag us into talking about this terrible show.
I won't, but it's just, it's the worst thing I've ever seen.
But it just mixed human.
Well, then why are you telling someone?
I couldn't stop watching it. It was a train wreck.
I mean, this like fulfilled the title of the, you know, Jurassic World better than just about anything like we've seen. And it was just really good. I mean, it for a short film, it did a really good job of getting the dinosaur kind of thrills and spectacle in there. Actually delivering like a grounded and good human story and still making it feel like intimate enough for you to care about these characters a great deal, not just physically, but even like on an emotional level. There was a part in the film with like a baby triceratops and one of the kids is like,
that hurt my soul.
See, like,
Kofi had me watch it. Like, and he watched my reaction in real time as I was watching it. And when that happens, I, like, lost my mind.
And you're, like, concerned.
And I was so mad at him.
Just for this little girl who's about to possibly see something horrible happen to a baby dinosaur. And you're like,
it was awful.
No, turn that kid away.
But it's okay.
Yeah, and it's great. Man. And I would love to see, I don't know. Have they announced who's directing 3 yet? I forget.
Trevorrow.
What's it?
Trevorrow.
He's coming back?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good news. I haven't. look, man, I don't care about the Jurassic
I wouldn't say it's so, good news, but it's something.
I also explains, yeah. I was like, I guess the biggest
this
thing.
This was his audition tape to say, hey, guys, I have
curious,
ideas.
The most
I
curious
suck.
Factor I had was that, like, where did this come from? As far as, like, that's a lot of budget
yeah.
to sink into a yeah. short film. Like, it looks really good. I also wouldn't say it has a, it's weird because, like, it doesn't really have a human story as much as, like, you're just watching these people
it doesn't,
terrified.
But, like, I already care more about Andre Holland's character than I do Chris Pratt's character.
I agree, but I'm thinking, like, that's the, I think that's the balance it needs to find, because I don't necessarily need, I've never needed this riveting human story, and the same thing goes for, like, the Godzilla films and, like, all these monster no. creature films. I just need to for this family or the group of characters to get me invested just in their personal survival. I don't need this long narrative.
No, it's, I mean, no, it's
you
supposed
don't
to be
need
simple
it.
Survival story. It's
this
like,
proves it. I don't
they
need
go that. In and they're, you know, whatever issues they go in with, like, just by surviving, and somehow yeah. they come out the other end and they've learned what they needed to learn.
Right.
Along
yeah,
the
but
that's all you need.
I think that goes two ways. So on one hand, I agree with you wholeheartedly. Like, when Godzilla King of Monsters came out, and I didn't love that movie, and a lot of people were just like, oh, but it's, you don't, it doesn't matter what. You know, but the people's story doesn't matter. It's all about the dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. Like, and I get that. But at the same time, the movie put a lot of emphasis on the people characters, and their mm-hmm. stories were not good. And that was a problem.
Yeah.
You know, so I get that. Like, make it more about the monsters. Make it about the dinosaurs. But at the same time, I look at Jurassic Park, which I still to this day think is one of the most perfect blockbuster ever made. I mean, I don't think that's a very hot of a take.
Okay, but here's the thing.
Jurassic Park.
Okay, but to go to that earlier discussion,
right?
You do.
But this is Jurassic
to the
Park.
Extreme like, level.
Yeah. It's not like, oh my god, guys. I think Jurassic
Park.
World is.
I'm just laughing because
Jurassic Park.
You just like
we literally just
phrased,
talked about it.
Yeah,
it's Jurassic Park.
It's for those
talking,
know,
you
want to
talk about iconic. That's one of the most iconic summer blockbusters.
The reason why we call him Turn Up Charlie Ridgely is because, like. Yeah, you just have these. It's not hyperbolic in the case of Jurassic Park, because you're right. I mean, Jurassic Park's a classic, but you do have tend to go for the hyperbolic rating of movies.
Like, listen, we spent all our time. Greatest movie my eyeballs have ever seen. I don't go that far.
Yesterday.
Like, I don't go that far, you know, but we're trying, like, we live on Twitter all the time, so it's like everything feels like it's always
Charlie,
dealt
I
extremes.
Love your enthusiasm for movies. That's why you're here.
Anyway, Jurassic Park is one of, not the most perfect blockbuster ever created. I stand by that 100%. I won't deviate from that no matter what you say or how much you make fun of me for anything
I don't
else.
Want you to change. I don't want you to change, Charlie.
That movie has so much narrative built into the human characters and very compelling, interesting human characters.
Yeah.
And the story ultimately.
One of the female characters that we didn't even know was like one of the best female characters for like a long time.
Laura Dern.
Yeah.
And that movie is so fantastic. And I mean, the little side plot of Jeff Goldblum, like it wasn't a full story, but like he had a narrative purpose. And, you know, the story of Alan and the kids and what that taught him. And
yeah, that was
like,
I mean, it was perfectly handled.
That movie was put together so well. And so I want to see these Jurassic films get to that point. You know, I think Lost World had it a little bit. It was a little over the top, but Lost
really?
World kind of better than most of them have.
I liked three better than.
Oh, see, I didn't. I disagree. I did not like three at all. Lost World and Fallen Kingdom are the ones that I enjoy of all the sequels. See, that's the grenade you blew by was my Fallen Kingdom thoughts.
Yeah,
but
that was really the.
We'll come to that another time.
Who knew?
But I want to see. You know, this was the first one that even got close to Jurassic Park in my
yeah.
opinion, like better than Lost World, better than Fallen Kingdom, better than three. I think this had compelling characters. They didn't show us much because it's only 8 minutes long,
yeah.
but they had story that they came in with, and they had something.
Well,
for you
it's a short story. I mean, you got to
right.
jump right in the middle of
right.
it.
Right, and it did its purpose perfectly. Yeah. But if we got a full movie with them, we would have, you know, hypothetically. Yeah. Seen the whole story play out, and their story was engaging and the story was interesting, like the dynamic of their mixed family.
That's why, that's the only thing, I mean, I think it's different for me is like this one made me realize, like, that's why I said I would love just to see like vignettes more so than the whole thing, because I realized if I had to spend a long time dealing with all the ups and downs of this family and stuff, like I would get sick of it, like in a movie. But just seeing things happening in real time, at, like in people in the middle of everyday situations. And then, oh crap! There's a dinosaur. Like,
well, that was one of my favorite parts about it. Is actually during the credits, is when they show all those little glimpses.
It was
of
a much better
things.
Version.
Yeah,
and just like, oh, this little dinosaur just running after this little girl on this.
We
on
were
the street.
I don't know if we're supposed to feel bad or not, but that was hilarious.
No, that was hilarious.
The little girl like running and crying, Well, there's little dinosaurs that killed the girl at the beginning of Lost World.
I did feel bad about the car that, like, it was played for laughs a little bit. Like, the car that goes sailing off the cliff. I was like, okay, it was kind of played as a, oh, no. And I'm like, no, that person died. That's legit. Like, no.
Yeah, but it's just like that would be, like, a really fun way of bringing back the Jurassic Park thing. But all right, the purpose of this is to say, all that is to say, if you haven't checked out Jurassic World Battle at Big Rock, go online, check it out. It's on YouTube. It's a good little short film.
Yeah,
very one cool. of the better Jurassic movies we've seen.
Most iconic time. Jurassic short film ever.
Yeah, another thing from the '90s that's having an unexpectedly good little hype behind it right now is Will Smith. Gemini Man first reactions are out, and you know I've been curious about this movie. We talked about it a couple times on the show. It's Ang Lee, and I think Ang Lee can do anything. Like, and he just, like, does everything because he's Ang Lee, and it's all awesome except for Hulk. But I was kind of curious to see what would happen with him and Will Smith making this movie. And so far, it's sounding like this is going to be a good movie. And I'm psyched.
Does it?
I mean, yeah.
I mean, the reactions from people who have seen it are positive as well.
Yeah, Will Smith does this thing. Oh, you're so cynical.
But they have
not,
though.
You pretend to be so helpful.
No, but they haven't. If you read all those reviews, which I did, they all praise how great it looks. And almost every single one goes, oh, but the story's stuck in the 90s, or the story's meh, or yeah, whatever, I mean, the character's meh. But man, young Will Smith looks great. I'm not cynical. I read.
Okay. What kind of Will Smith do you want to see?
That's
2019 Will Smith or 1990s Will Smith?
But that's what the
reviews said. This is what's going to bring out the people. Young Will Smith looks great. It's a technological thing. His performance. People say that like he has a good performance in the movie.
I didn't see that in almost any of those reviews. I didn't see it at all. Like, no one said that. No one said that. They all said, this is gorgeous. This proves 4K and 120 frames and all this. I saw all that. But none of them said a great
slide
story.
On comicbook.com.
And what does it say?
Gemini Man is a huge breakthrough. Action sequence are breathtaking in the format. Will Smith's winning performance shows the level of scrutiny a real movie star can stand up to.
That Will Smith one, I did not see that part.
If you've ever needed evidence that Matt is a hater.
No, read the rest of them.
Feel free to read the rest of them online. To return an item to the store, all I need is one.
Oh, yeah, okay. So,
one receipt.
Go read the article.
That's all I need.
And read all of them because it's all, hey, this looks pretty. This looks great.
You aren't mentioning the best thing I've seen in these tweets. The best tweet review I've seen of this.
And Lee delivers bold action. Like, people are saying it's a good action movie.
They're
with great visuals
and
a winning performance for Will Smith.
Young Will Smith.
Don't Jim
throws
Cardi
not
me. That's one tweet.
Give me a break. Young Will Smith throws not one, but two motorcycles at his older self.
There was absolutely none, and I found one in 2 seconds.
I will say, I missed that one. I missed that part.
So is it possible? Let's do this like a courtroom.
I looked at all of
them. Mr. Aguilar, do you think, based on what you have seen, it is possible, simply possible, that there could be other reviews
praising
Will Smith's performance?
Absolutely.
I rest my case.
You based this on that article, and I didn't see that one.
I know. Well, who knew this was, you know, man, you never know what the grenades are going to be on this show.
And I'm not a cynical person. I just look at that and go, I'm seeing a lot of the same stuff that Avatar had, which is it's really pretty, and it sets all these new standards for technology, and the movie's meh. The movie's forgettable.
To be fair, no one said that when Avatar came out.
Stop it. Who knew this was going to be the grenade?
No, I mean, we all think that now. I'm just saying the critics
all
weren't
right.
talking about
all
that when
right.
Avatar came out.
They were saying
moving
it was
right
a
along.
Huge technological marvel.
Yeah, and they were saying it was a great movie experience. Like,
yeah.
They
buried the lead and didn't tell us that the story sucked.
Not even sucked. I won't
because
even say sucked. It's just mediocre.
Oh, my God. A lot of people don't think the story... I'm a secret Avatar apologist. I'm not doing this right now. But, like, a lot of people...
You want
Jim
to talk about
Cameron
me having hot
picks
takes.
The most friendly around-the-campfire archetypes for stories that we tell over and over again.
Yes.
And he just tells the same
story.
Because James Cameron's overrated. No one will admit it.
Oh, I didn't say
that. Man.
Did I call it bad, though?
What
no, I
happened?
Said it's average.
Average. Look what Gemini Man has done. All right, we're moving along. We got to pull this back together because we're not going to yell about Avatar today. Avatar 2 is coming. We'll have plenty of time to yell about Avatar. All right.
Anyway,
One story we missed on our last episode that I just want to play cleanup for is that Game of Thrones is continuing to expand. We have a prequel that's already in production with Naomi Watts, and it's about the old world, the Age of Heroes, and all that stuff. But Now we're getting one that people will actually care about more, which is that we're getting one about fire and blood. Dude, come on.
But we're like, just courting the hate today.
I mean, only Game of Thrones diehards like myself care about like the age of heroes 1,000 years before the Andals come. Only like 20% of the Game of Thrones viewers even would understand if I said 1,000 years before the Andals come. They'd be like, what are Andals? Like, you know, all that stuff's confusing to a lot of people. So this one's a lot more simple. Fire and blood. It's the story of the Targaryens, you know, empire, that they have dragons, silver hair, stuff we know from Game of Thrones, easy to follow. So that is coming, and that's probably a smart move for HBO. That seems like a much more reliable show
concept.
It's going
to be a more marketable
show. Yeah, and the stories are badass stories that we want to see. Like, I want to see the Dance of Dragons. I want to see the whole kind of, like, Targaryen weird... It's going to be a lot of incest stuff. I don't know.
I think just being a, for those of us who are like big fans of it, like I'm more interested in the other one.
I mean, yeah.
See different corner, but saying it's a Targaryen show is way more marketable to, you know, to a general audience.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I want to see new things we don't know anything about. And, you know, like this history. That's
I mean,
been
there was
untold.
A Fire and Blood book too. So like that kind of broke down, but it wasn't like a novel. It was like broke down. It was a history book. Targaryens, and here, we'll just give you the dramatic reading.
I want to get to the point in
centuries
my
before the events of
historical text.
Game of Thrones. House Targaryen, the only family of dragon lords to survive the doom of Valyria, took up residence on Dragonstone. Fire and Blood begins their tale with the legendary Aegon the Conqueror, creator of the Iron Throne, and goes on to recount the generations of Targaryens who fought to hold that iconic seat all the way up to the civil war that nearly tore their dynasty apart. I said dynasty on purpose, by the way. Dynasty apart. A dynasty.
Honestly, it sounds kind of lame.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, because we know what happened. Like, we know their story.
It's a prequel.
Right, but the other one's a prequel and we don't know anything about
it. Yeah, so far they're playing with the idea that, I mean, in Game of Thrones itself ends with the idea that the history books are all wrong.
When was the last time something as big as Game of Thrones got a prequel?
I don't know.
You don't?
No.
Star Wars?
Oh my!
I thought maybe that's where you're going with that, but
I was stuck in the land of TV. I was like,
one of these prequels.
Richard stood up and shook his head from the booth.
I enjoy the prequels. It's just they messed like it was not of the quality of the original.
He's left the booth.
And Clone Wars.
Richard
is awesome.
Has left the booth and is coming to hunt you down.
Clone Wars is the worst one, but that's beside the point.
No, not that's the movie. The Clone Wars series was a prequel.
I was thinking Attack of the Clones.
Yeah.
So. What I'm saying though is they're making these prequel shows, they're making these spinoff shows. One of them is bound to suck.
Yeah. No.
I really believe that.
Oh man, this is gonna be the hate that we have to endure.
But this is full of grenades.
I'm saying one of them. I'm excited. I'm a fan. I want them to all be good.
I think one of them will not work out. The guy who's a big fan of this, I'm kind of excited to see the other one because it's the story, I think. We don't know anything about it, but what we suspect is the story of how one of the first Andals showed up on the continent. And Andals are basically like Game of Thrones code for white people. Like,
thank you.
Europeans. Like
he looked directly at me when he was explaining it, and I was just like, yeah, sure, whatever.
Because I know you don't follow
yeah, we'll let it go.
And so like one of the first blonde hair guys shows up, and it's the guy who builds the Lannister family and the Empire. And there's kind of hints that this could be the story that we get, and that's going to be great for us who love these deep cuts and would learn to like find out that it's completely different than we thought from the world of Game of Thrones, how this all came about and all that got built.
I just think the Targaryen story is kind of
more fixed. Yeah,
well, it's so cyclical.
Yeah,
you know, and that was the whole point they were making in the final season of like, oh, we're going to let Dany repeat history.
Well, they're just going to make a whole and series so, like, to justify what happened.
So we've
to Dany.
Seen it already, is what I'm saying. Like it happened with Dany.
Well, they got to defend why Dany went
Aegon,
crazy.
Aegon,
so
and then her
look,
father.
See,
and it's just,
that's what happened to her. Those bells. See what happened to bells?
I don't want that.
I mean, but it's happening, my friend.
Right. That's my whole point. Is that it's marketable. It's going to do well.
Yeah.
But I think that one has potential to not be very good.
Somebody's going to see that first teaser, and all they're going to see is Game of Thrones and fire and blood and a dragon symbol. They're going to be like, ah! And it's going to be great. People are going to love it. All right.
Wait, what's happening? What are they going to be like?
It's happening. Last thing I had is just a quick one. Watchmen put out a new trailer. What the hell is this show?
What show?
Watchmen. And is this show going to do anything? Like, I'm kind of worried about this. Here's my worry about Watchmen. I'm going to like it as an HBO prestige show, okay? Mm. That's why I'm going to watch it, and I think it'll be interesting to me. My concern is it's going to fall right between the cracks of relevance, which is hardcore fans are not necessarily going to embrace this. Oh, you know, hardcore fans of the comics, especially the I only read the comics, screw what the movie did, Zack Snyder messed it up, purists aren't necessarily going to be behind this. It may be too weird and kind of out there for mainstream viewers to try to figure out what the hell this is all related to and then kind of retroactively come back to Watchmen and what that's all about. And that's my one concern.
I don't think they're going to need to. Like, I mean, Westworld was weird. Westworld had crazy trailers.
You didn't have to, like, go back to the Westworld movie at all.
I don't think you're going to have to.
Figure out.
Well, that, I think that's the biggest
thing. Lindelof has said, like, you're not going to... If you read the comics, like, you're going to have maybe a deeper appreciation for this, but you don't have to read them in order to watch the show.
I think
it'll provide you some context.
I think half of this first episode, premiere episode, is going to be Watchmen references.
So I agree. And what I will say first is that when I first watched this trailer, I wasn't sold either. Really. I was like, what is this really about? And honestly, I still can't really tell you what, like, the main plot line of this thing is about, because there's a lot of stuff happening. However, the second time around, it actually got me excited. I am actually excited to see this. I think Lindelof was smart about putting that, like, letter out and really, like, hey, explaining that he's not. I think he will get more fans, like, hardcore fans, than he would have before he did the letter, which was like, hey, I'm not screwing with the book. Whatever happened in there happened. Like, all that stuff really happened. Like, the ramifications and, like, people who are dead are, like, we're not going to go messing up Alan Moore stuff. We are going to act like it's kind of like a Bible and then add on and go forward. I think that earned him some goodwill amongst that community. So I don't think it'll be so hate. We don't like anything Watchmen. Stop messing with
it. But also, how much crossover? Yeah. Like, I want to see the Venn diagram of the Watchmen diehards and then the dedicated HBO viewers. Like, what's the crossover there? Because there's going to be a large chunk of HBO of people who are watching the show because it's just the new show on HBO.
I mean, truthfully, I think there's way more HBO people.
Right. Yeah, I'm saying, like,
I think the only thing that's even close
is something not being loyal to a comic going to deter enough people from watching a show on HBO because HBO has its own audience. And that's part of what's so good about the show.
I think it'll do well. But I don't think it'll suffer as much from that, like, hardcore hate as we initially thought. I also think it's doing some really interesting things with, like, the Rorschachs and, like, all those different, you know, like, was it Mr. Glass or whatever? Like, what's the
when you see Hourglass Tim Blake Nelson's character with that, like, chrome mask? It's like, oh, I'm so in on that.
No, there's a lot of really crazy cool, like, imagery. I mean, a lot of this looks like some Twin Peaks stuff. Like, I mean, it looks all crazy and intriguing to the eye.
And as for Watchmen, you see that one scene later when Owlman's ship. Right.
Yeah.
Like, Night Owl ship hits, and you're crashes. Like, if you don't read the book, you don't know what that is.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
there's going to be a lot of those. Like, you don't understand who Rorschach or the significance of the mask, you know.
But this is what we talk about
there's
all the
be
time
a lot of that stuff.
With the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Like, there's things that if you know the books, you know the comics, you recognize a thing and it's important to you. But if you're watching the movie with no context of the comics, you still get what's happening. They'll introduce you to a character you don't know.
Yes.
You don't know when you watch the first Captain America, oh, Bucky ends up becoming the Winter Soldier. As a comic fan, you know that. As a fan, you're just like, oh, I have all the context I need for Bucky, and I get all the context I need for the Winter Soldier in the next movie.
But Watchmen, the HBO series, is like, if you just sat down and started watching the Winter Soldier and had never seen the first Avenger,
I think Lindelof is smarter than that.
But it's a wait and see. We don't know yet.
Right.
It's up to him.
We don't know that. That is correct.
To close that gap. But you're right, because this story already happened. You were coming in midway or after. It's sequel territory. So,
or even better, it's like going into Civil War and being like, there's this huge thing happening and not knowing who Captain America ever was, who Iron Man ever was, who Bucky or the Winter Soldier ever was, or any of that.
Like, there's a whole society of these dudes with masks, and you don't understand where that comes from.
The dudes with masks have nothing to do with the previous dudes with masks. It's a whole new way of life, and it,
that we know of
because of what happened.
Yes.
And but you have that link in Ozymandias, which I think is going to be the big, like, how we learn the story. Mm-hmm. You know, because Ozymandias lived through it, and now he's alive now. And
there's
so we're going to
be some exposition dump necessary, yes.
Right.
All right. Well, moving right along, we're not going to get too hung up. Be sure to stay tuned, because when we get back, we're going to deep dive into two things. We're going to break down the game-changing twist of Marvel's House of X number 5, and we will review American Horror Story 1984, the new season of the acclaimed anthology series. So be sure to stay tuned for when we get back. All right, so House of X 5. You know, we've been doing this week to week. We're just on this steady Jonathan Hickman, X-Men event kind of, we're like roadies for this thing, I guess, now, as we're just helping this thing down the track. And we're coming towards the end of the story. This is House of X 5, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh my God, it just dawned on me. We only have one more issue of House of X. Oh.
Yeah, two powers and one house left.
Oh.
It's nuts, yeah.
Oh, man, that's rough. So this is the penultimate issue of House of X.
Dawn of X?
And
X-Men?
Yeah.
Like Marauders.
Yeah, it's going to be crazy. It's what's coming up down the pike. But so this was the issue that picks up after the mission to Orcus to destroy the Mother Mold. And after some strange detours in the Power of X issue that followed to Mr. Sinister and this kind of backstory of Xavier trying to create this mutant DNA library, House of X 5 comes along and confirmed a lot of our suspicions, which was the X-Men who died on that suicide mission. Cyclops, you know, Jean Grey, Nightcrawler, Wolverine, Angel, Husk, M, Mystique. I keep forgetting Mystique died. I keep forgetting about
because
Mystique.
Because we're so forgetful.
Yeah. But all those people who died were not going to stay dead very long. They get resurrected. And this issue basically takes us through what the real kind of social order of Krakoa is, how it's different, and how this mutant society is very different this time around. Like, this isn't just Utopia 2.
Yeah.
It's not just a place. Or Genosha, which were mutant havens, but they were just places.
Yeah.
Like, physical locations where you walked in and you were safe as a mutant. This is an entire culture that they are building. They've built their own language. Now we see this almost religious side of things in this issue, which is fun in a lot of ways because, again, Hickman just scoops up big-ass handfuls of X-Men lore and just, like, mashes them in his hand like dirt and makes, like, a little big fun ball and then just, like, tosses it in the room. And it's pretty awesome. So this one has, like, these five repurposed X-Men characters, including the most unlikely X-Men character of all, Goldballs.
Goldballs!
Like, yeah, Goldballs. A guy whose power is literally making bouncing gold balls. So take that how
whenever
you will.
You say that, in my head, I think of Gold Dust, the wrestler.
Oh.
I think of like an like archer. I think of an archer villain. Like
I think of
would
gold
be
member.
Like gold ball. Like kind of a James Bond.
The point is, none of us take it seriously. No. That name. And,
yeah, it's hard to take him seriously.
I love gold.
But now he's a religious figure of the X-Men. Like, this is what he's done. So basically, these five mutants, gold balls, Tempest is one of them, Elixir, Hope, Summers, and
the P, didn't it?
Did you get Tempest, right?
That's a Tempest.
Okay.
Did it start with a P?
Huh?
Wait, Proteus.
The name.
Proteus is the other one, yeah. Freaking Proteus. And so, like, they all become, they're using Krakoa, and I think this is one of the interesting ideas that I really love, is they're learning how to sync up mutant powers to function collectively.
Yeah.
And to put the powers together to do, and they say this interesting thing, like, you know, the Hickman points out, like, you know, in the comics it's always been for aggression, how to kind of combine powers like a speed, like, you know, fastball special, like, for just fighting. But, like, what happens when you start to combine powers for like lifestyle and culture stuff, like a habitat or this process, in this case, of cheating death, which is what these five X-Men do. So Gold Balls makes balls that turn out to be eggs. They're bioorganic eggs. They use the DNA from Sinister's library to kind of mature these eggs using Tempest and Elixir and Gold Balls together.
And Proteus alters reality to make an embryo be able to actually be in the egg. Which is just nuts. That's such a cool way to use his abilities.
So he just makes it possible, through altering reality. and Hope Summers synchronizes and amplifies all their powers for the better success rate.
Thank you, Hickey.
And they basically can grow new mutant bodies that are fully within powers, too. So they can create, like, a new Cyclops body with optic blasts. That's not all. Because you can't just have an empty shell, we learn that, oops, Cerebro isn't just this mutant locating computer. It's also a mutant soul-storing database, basically, that Charles Xavier has been subconsciously taking, you know, psychic imprints of all the mutants he's made contact with and now has this library of basically mutant mind souls that he can pull out and restore into an empty body shell and therefore basically bring the dead mutant back to life and just create and basically download the, so it's like hardware software in a Hickman world.
Yeah. That has to tie. I'm just had a thought on the way you were explaining it. Like, have we gone back and looked at how that ties into powers three issues ago? Like, remember that's what they went and stole from, like, all the stuff they were getting from Nimrod was the location of the database of all the mutant genes and stuff.
And what they stole from
was the location where to get it.
No, they stole Nimrod's
when
origin
he came date. Online.
Yeah,
the first time he came online, that's what they stole. Yeah. Well, the first time they went, they stole the location of the thing they needed, and then the second time they got when he came online.
That was
But the whole thing with Nimrod is he collects all of the data.
That stuff was the sinister.
Yeah, he took
thread.
Yeah, he was took the sinister.
But it's all powers in the future, is what I'm saying. Like, I feel like that has to somehow connect to the fact that they download all this data and Charles uses it to then recreate life.
The way they say it is that Cerebro has always
the mutant
had it.
DNA library.
Cerebro has it, but then these are taking place in the future.
The mutant DNA library has been a running thing throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
Right. I'm saying
it shows up in Nimrod's future, but it's also in 1,000
all of that
years
is
future,
in the future
because that's the very first scene in the librarian's future is them trying to access it and rebuild these mutants starting with Cyclobel.
Right.
And they're trying to do it, but they can't because the material's deteriorated over 1,000 years after House of X. So it's no longer viable. So that's a big part of this. And I think these are just setups. I think this mutant DNA library is going to be just a big part of the X-Men world going forward.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be, like, finalized in this. It'll just be a big factor in everything that, you know, happens going forward. Because this whole, like, resurrection process is going to possibly be part of the story going forward. Like, you know, X-Men.
Well, it's got to be, right? Because in, what was it, in the previews for December.
Oh, yeah, we already saw. That's right. People are still coming out of eggs.
So like, people are still coming out of eggs. Also, like, mutant kind is the number one, is the dominant species on Earth.
Yeah.
So, like, at some point, they have to get around that, you know, and I'm curious to see how that happens. Because I mean, to me, that's like in this book, they tease, right? Like what it would take to bring the Genosha level of mutants.
Yeah.
Back.
Actual math for what it would take to bring all 16 million dead mutants of Genosha back.
Dude.
And so that was a big second reveal. So you have this religious ceremony where they bring back all the dead X-Men from the Mother Mold mission. And they have this ceremony where Storm reintroduces him and says, "This is my sister. I know her. Who is she?" And they're like, "Mutant." And they have like a whole like little cultural ceremony.
Yeah.
And then the other two big developments in the issue are Charles Xavier convinces the leaders of the world using his like semi-bribery of the flowers of Krakoa produce these drugs that they can give to humans to like cure disease and like extend lifespan and all this stuff.
And Emma being awesome.
Yeah.
And that was so much bribery. It's like he put the deal on the table.
Well, it's political
day.
Coercion is what it is.
But Emma also pushed.
It was a deal. It's
people.
Like, you leave us alone, we give you this. We're not obligated to give it to you, but like.
Well, I'm not here to be the moral judge, but it is political coercion. It is like, give me my own sovereign nation and you can have these things. And if you don't, you don't get them. So, like, yeah, that is political coercion. But anyway, the point is he wins. He gets it for most nations. There's a whole, like, nifty little map drawn because we need more charts of, like, who doesn't accept the deal. And it's, like, it's classic places like Madripoor doesn't.
My favorite thing of all of it.
Madripoor is, like, we're a pirate base.
All of those locations.
Wakanda doesn't.
It listed all the locations of, like, who was not in agreement to the deal and why. And they were like, some were like political reasons and some were social.
Ideological.
Right. And they got to Wakanda and Wakanda was like, they don't need the medicine. Yeah. Like Wakanda was like,
we
don't need it.
Wakanda has no need of
medicine. It was so great because they're like, oh, Wakanda's just their own thing.
They
it's
already
fine.
Got that stuff.
So
that
the X-Men Krakoa becomes its own officially recognized mutant nation of in the world. So that's a big deal. That's happened before, but now, this is Hickman is more complex, complex and nuanced than Genosha and stuff, which is like, okay, mutants go there, go away. You have your own island. This one is actually hooked into the world economy, trade deals, politics, like all of this stuff, religion, language, like. It is a full nation.
And that bodes so well for the future because one of the biggest problems with X-Men over the last, 7, 8 years has been like they always feel like they're pushed out here.
Yeah.
It's like everything else is going on in the Marvel Universe. And then, like, when an event happens, they get a tie-in issue, but they're always over here.
Marvel's going to let them be separate.
What do you mean?
Like, I mean, obviously, there are...
No, but I'm saying this is why that's promising.
Right. It's promising, but also, like, there's so many stories you can tell of just the mutants now. And it's like, how long do you think that Marvel lets them kind of like tell their own stories without?
Well, I don't think this is going to be an easily retcon thing because it makes more sense. I think it'll become something that becomes a signature of their characters.
Yeah, like, I mean, I hope so. I want that.
And that's what's kind of happening. It's like the basic question of what does it be to be mutant? I mean, Charles Xavier's trying to unify everybody just because, oh, you have powers, you're a mutant. And it's like, well, that's not it. And Hickman's doing the brave thing. And I've been trying to find ways to write about this without starting a Matt International incident. What about like the deeper meaning of what it means to be a minority culture and like what it is and you know what that means or just a culture at all. I mean, because this one kind of plays with the idea of what it is to be a minority culture in general once they're the dominant species, you know. But what it is to be a culture because mutants have never been unified under a real culture of what it means to be a mutant
right
now.
And it plays very similar to the way that, you know, especially in the movie, the way that they handle Wakanda in Black Panther. And it was like, what if we were just left alone? Like, how much would we thrive if no one ever hurt us? Like, what would that have looked like?
Yeah, but that also required secrecy. This is very public. And as you saw,
it's a very different approach.
Realize that a Wakanda existed. And I'm sure the next film will explore that in great detail. It changes everything.
Yeah.
In this case, the X-Men, it's going to change everything. Like, knowing there's a nation of mutants with their own economic power base, political power base, and social power base, like, it's not going to be chill for a lot of people. Orcus is still in there.
We've already seen this in small doses in House, right? When Fantastic Four courts.
Those are going to be interesting. Just like the amnesty clause of all of this. Mutants are their own species and therefore not like governed by human laws or subject to like human jurisdiction.
So interesting.
You got it. No. We handle our own stuff internally. It's kind of like very Israeli almost. Like, and that's the thing. There's shades of so many things. And that was like one of my favorite things was the speech Magneto is giving to Polaris in the beginning when they're talking about humans have taught us one good lessons about society. It's a very kind of echoing of Judaism and that kind of culture that's like passed down from a guy who survived the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And it was just so many levels of great. Like, and I really love this issue. We're just kind of skipping the headline here. So after they get their own nation, Charles Xavier makes this bold move of, this is going to be a truly unified mutant nation, and that means there is no more good and evil mutants. Like, we're dropping all that. Mutant is mutant, and, like, so therefore the shores of Krakoa are open to everybody. And Krakoa is a big place. It's not, like, a tiny place. So, yeah, people can spread out. There's multiple habitats. There's all this stuff. So you can spread out, but, like, everybody comes through the portals. You're like, it's like a reverse Avengers Endgame. Like, portals open and all the bad guys
like
step out.
Mr. Sinister.
Yeah, we have a full list. I think there's about 21 altogether X-Men villains that kind of just show up for these cameos in this, led by none other than Apocalypse, who has one of the greatest X-Men scenes ever, just comes into his new home where he and the X-Men are now living under the same roof, and Wolverine's just standing there because Wolverine is just like has a problem with it. And I love that they draw it to scale, so like Apocalypse is so huge. Wolverine's like this tiny angry man like standing in front of him. And Apocalypse is just like, they're like, yo, you're gonna be a problem. He's like, what are you talking about? I've been waiting for this. Like,
I was way ahead of y'all with this. Like,
I was an OG of standing.
I know we've mentioned it before, but like Apocalypse has probably been Hickman's best.
No, we've
character.
Been talking about it. Like, yeah, this House of X is subtly like just done so many things to steer Apocalypse into such a much more interesting place as
very
a character
so.
Instead of like this arch fiend. Like, you find out like he's this multiple realities of level in history of hero. Like, fought back the demons, took on the man machine supremacy. Like,
you know, he's done so much, and the stuff that they've like Hickman, right, has been teasing the return of the Four Horsemen.
Yeah.
But it's the spin he puts on it that is what makes it interesting.
To
is that,
be fair, I think the Four Horsemen already exist.
No, I'm saying
and
that's
and they
as
belong
far
to,
as...
They belong to Charles.
Well, I don't know about that.
Because the Four Horsemen were left. They have been stranded there.
I mean, I'm saying, look at how Charles has operated society. There is himself, who doesn't really talk to the rest of the people.
Yeah.
And then he has, like, essentially his generals in front of him. And I believe there are four, right? Because there's Beast, Storm, Magneto, and there's one more, right? Was it Polaris? When he was waiting behind when the X-Men were sacrificed, there was one more person that was there. I think it was Polaris.
Might have been.
But it's very much a similar. I mean, he's not bringing on the end of the world, but he's bringing on the end of the human world with four generals.
But I think the horsemen are not tied to that because they were left.
No, I'm not. They're not tied. I'm saying now Apocalypse is here and he sees how things work, and we don't know how what's going to go. It's very parallel.
No, but there is an event coming where
those are coming back.
Original four horsemen.
Oh, okay. The original. I think the concept of the four horsemen was coming back.
The original four horsemen that were left because he was a hero and they essentially he sacrificed them, but they sacrificed and stood the guard.
Yeah.
And so they're going
to
bring
other
them back.
Half of Krakoa that's now in the demon realm, I guess.
Yeah. And how many times, though, have we seen the Four Horsemen, right? He gets a new group of Four Horsemen. But this is so unique and original. It's because Hickman finds a cool way to make them heroes
and
almost.
In the Sinister Rumors, it says that he like truly loves the original Four.
Yeah.
And that basically it kind of reframes that his attempts to recreate them are just to make these bastardized versions of the friends he like,
lost
and sacrificed.
That's so interesting, and I can't believe that story we've seen 90 times.
Is now
I'm excited about.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So you guys have been reading X-Men for way longer than I am. I know we don't have a lot of time, so I don't want to like, make a big discussion out of this. But I want to hear from you guys. Like, it's almost over. Where do you think this is gonna fall in like the pantheon of?
I mean, I think
great
it's gonna be. I was thinking about
stories.
That yesterday.
Like,
it's an instant classic already. House of X 2 is already an instant classic.
Like the Dawn of X,
I mean,
X story.
There's
together.
Like three House of X books I would put like a top like my but top I mean, like, 20 books.
The way
time.
I see it, and I'm not as X Men as you guys. You haven't been reading it as long, but it seems like it's going to be there with the House of M's and with the
Age of
Claremont
Apocalypse,
runs with
X-Men.
New X Men with
it will.
Astonishing.
I mean, this will
like,
be a moment
be
that
there.
It changed everything. I have not talked about the X Men this much in years. I haven't talked about comics this much in years, and I haven't thought about a storyline this much in years. Like, it's going to be up there with the greats.
It's automatically up there, right? Like you said, half those books right now, I would count in my top whatever, and it's up there. It's already there.
Yeah. So we're going to move on because we got to finish up the show and today. But we're going to come to the end of this and we're going to be like, whoa, mind blown by the end of this, I'm sure. It's going to be great getting to this new era of X-Men. So to finish up today, me and Charlie are just going to do a quick review of American Horror Story 1984. Matt's too scared to watch it, so he's going to sit out.
I don't like scary things.
I'm just kidding.
I don't like scary things.
So when we last left off, it was Apocalypse, which was a kind of a coven sequel with a little murder house thrown in twist. And I liked Apocalypse. I think you were kind of middling on
it. All right.
It was all right, yeah.
I liked
what did
it at
you
the
think
kind
of 1984's premiere episode? And
I really
basically the premise
the
of
premiere.
The season is so far it's kind of an ode to slasher films.
Yeah, and that's
and Friday the 13th.
I really loved it, and I hate that I really loved it because it's American Horror Story, and I know that it's not gonna stay this way. Because it's hard.
It's very straightforward. It was very literal.
Yeah,
like, we were all
it's very hard to think
some
back.
Kind of rug pulling twist.
Yeah,
but it was very straightforward. It was
remember,
faithfully
Asylum was very
in,
straightforward.
Yeah, I know.
In,
I'm just saying.
Premiere.
I'm just trying to set the scene for people who are just listening. Like it so far, it's just been kind of a 1984 VHS style.
Right.
Ode to a slasher
like,
movie
the,
about
the
people
filmmaking,
going to
a camp. Like the camera work is reminiscent of the 80s. Like the actual quality of the film looks like it's from the 80s. The characters are really overly campy in the best way. You know, Billy Lord's character is phenomenal. Matthew Morrison, like they all do a great job. It feels like the 80s. And like I said to you earlier, I think that this one episode feels like the first act of a Friday the 13th movie. It kind of sets the stage, sets the characters, it kind of has the looming threat, has the old stories, and towards the end of the episode, there's one big, you know, chase thing that ultimately doesn't result in a lot of carnage, but for one or two characters, they see what's happening, and we see what's happening, but not everybody does. It's very much in the vein of those sleepaway camps in Friday the 13th, and I'm really excited for what's next, but at the same time, like, I'm terrified this is only going to last for three or four episodes before Ryan Murphy does what Ryan Murphy does and just pulls the rug out and says it's actually this totally different thing. And then it just gets weird and doesn't make any sense anymore and loses all the charm that it had at the beginning. But, I mean, as a single episode, I thought this was great.
Yeah, I kind of like a lot of the twist. I don't hate it, and I've been a big fan of the deeper mythology of American Horror Story and the Seven Deadly Sins theory and all that, which would make this season the Lust season. I think Wrath was last season, like, yeah. Anyway, so I think there's going to... I'm not so mad about the twist, but I agree with you in the sense that I get the sense that this whole slasher film thing can't last for an entire season.
Right.
This is the first act, like you said, and only a couple like murders happen. We still have a full cast of characters, but it's got to start picking up because I think if we're just going through like 5 to 6 episodes of them just... seeing the killer across the lake and then he goes back in the woods and then almost gets them. Like, yeah, that gets really tedious really fast.
Mm.
I'm just trying to get, let's see, what do you guess the twist would be for this season?
I mean, we've been talking, there's some talk about 1984, the name of it itself. Like he chose this because it was a great era for slashers. It was, they're using, what's the real killer they're using, in the show? The serial killer that came to her, I can't remember the name of the killer.
Oh, I forget his name. Ramirez.
A real killer.
He was in a hotel too. He's a real guy, and he's referenced in a hotel.
And so
that was a hotel connection.
And he was killing people in 1984. But there's the whole idea that 1984 is a nod to George Orwell and the whole Big Brother thing, and they're all being watched, very Cabin of the Woods style. There's theories that it's all they are actually making a movie. And we're watching the production of a movie, kind of a Roanoke type of twist.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Which I liked in Roanoke. I wouldn't want to see it again, but I enjoyed the way they did Roanoke, where it was half and half, and it was two completely different stories.
Yeah, but it was them making a reality show that turned out to be real.
Yeah, yeah. I think Murphy really has such wonderful ideas and kind of loses himself the farther he goes. So Roanoke, I think, worked because it wasn't just, a bunch of different twists here and there. It was a very clear, like, ending to Act 1, beginning of Act 2. So you kind of close things off and then start new things and keep it contained. And so I liked what we did there, but I don't know if this is going to be more like that or more like Hotel, where there are a million doors opening every which way, or Apocalypse, where they're bringing all these other things, or Cult, where it was just constantly... peeling back layers. It's
or
really
Freak
tough
Show,
to see
which got really tedious and stretched out. Like
weirdly, Freak Show is my favorite one outside of Murder House.
No, love Freak Show. No,
a lot of it because Danny Mott is one of the best villains
Asylum.
That they've had.
I liked Asylum a lot.
I liked Asylum when I went back and finally finished it. I really enjoyed Asylum.
But even Cult was different than I thought it was.
To kind of set it in perspective, though, this premiere is one of my favorites of the series. Like right there with Murder House. And Asylum, like this is a great premiere.
Yeah, it was pretty good. It was pretty tight and creepy throughout. And there was some really good scenes where they introduced a killer when he was a bit in Asylum, and he does like that neat little trick.
It was very, very, very Halloween, which that lends itself, I think, to the whole movie making idea because there were very clear tropes picked from different horror movies, which you can argue is just a filmmaking style and a choice that Murphy's making to have a nod to those things. But like the way that Mr. Jingles, escapes prison was like, that's Michael Myers.
Yeah.
It was very, very taken from that. It kind of leads you on a rabbit trail in your mind.
Yeah. So, all right, that'll do it. American Horror Story 1984 is on now. You can catch it Wednesdays on FX. And we'll let you know when the big twist comes. We're not going to talk about it every week, but when the big twist comes and the rug gets pulled, we'll be back to tell you what that's all about and see how we feel about it. All right, that'll do it for this episode of Comic Book Nation. Thank you for joining in. If you're just getting acquainted with the show, we put up new episodes every Wednesday and Friday on comicbook.com, where we have an RSS feed you can subscribe to, or you can subscribe on different listening platforms. We're on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Google Playlist, or you can tell any Amazon Alexa device, play Comic Book Nation podcast, and it will fire right up for you. If you want to continue the discussion about anything we discussed today, or just yell at us, you can always find us at the hashtag Comic Book Nation, or you can find me at Kofi Outlaw.
You can find me at Matt Aguilar CB.
And I'm at Charlie Ridgely.
And if you like the show, please go on, or just want a free t-shirt, go on iTunes, leave us a 5-star review. We periodically read reviews on the show, and if we read yours, we will send you a free Comic Book Nation t-shirt. So be sure to get those in and keep them coming, because we're getting these shipping the shirts out quicker this, you know, we're getting them quicker, making it happen. So we will be back for another round of review readings pretty soon. Other than that, thank you guys for joining us today. This is Comic Book Nation, and we're out.
Yes.